Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Vlad Jr. hitting 91 home runs, 91 bombs last night was a pretty good reminder that guys are hitting a lot of home runs this year. A lot. Like nearly 3,700 of them before the All-Star break. And you don't need exactly be on pace guy to recognize that at that rate, they're going to break the all-time season record for home runs. That record currently is 6,105. That was set back in 17. Not just beat that record, but obliterate it. Smash it by roughly 500 home runs. That's not just a lot of home runs. That is an absolute bleep ton. It's comical. Unless, of course, you're on the bump. Unless, of course, you're a pitcher. And in that case, it's a reason to go. In the case of Justin Verlander, it has him dropping F-bombs. He told Jeff Passan, quote, "It's a bleeping joke." But he went with the F-bomb. You know, just another pitcher getting lit up, looking to blame anybody and anything while refusing to look in the mirror. Not actually. Verlander has been lights out in the first half, but he's been torched by the long ball, and he's pissed, and he insists he knows the reason, and it's not what the seam heads will have you believe. You see, at this point, a lot of seam heads are running in here to say that it could be any number of different reasons why this is happening. Analytics, launch angles, spin rates, guys going for one of three outcomes, a home run, a strikeout, or a walk, more power pitchers. It can be anything at all. But not if you ask one of those power pitchers, Verlander. He's pretty clear on why more home runs are being hit and who's the one behind it. He said, quote, "Major League Baseball's turning this game into a joke. They own Rawlings. You've got Manfred up here saying it might be the way they center the pill. They own the bleeping company. If any other $40 billion company bought out a $400 million company and the product changed dramatically, it's not a guess as to what happened. We all know what happened. Manfred, the first time he came in, what did he say? He said, we want more offense. All of a sudden, he comes in, the balls are juiced. It's not a coincidence. We're not idiots." End quote. Hell yes. Verlander saying Major League Baseball's turning this game to a joke is awesome. And then him chasing that by calling out the commissioner for saying that there might be something with the ball, then pointing out that MLB, quote, owns the bleeping company is so good. And let me jump in here right now and say, this is not some scrub. This is not some hack. This is not some ham and egger, some wannabe complaining. It's a future Hall of Famer, an eight-time All-Star, an AL MVP, a Cy Young Award winner, the starting pitcher in tonight's All-Star game. And he's shouting that MLB is turning the game into a joke. He's saying that the baseballs are juiced and, quote, we're not idiots. And the guy's right, of course. That's not an expression or figure of speech about Major League Baseball owning Rawlings. Major League Baseball bought Rawlings last summer. They do own the company. And while it's been an ongoing issue for quite some time, MLB did do a study, and they came back with the results that the baseballs were acting differently. But they wouldn't say why. They didn't attribute a reason. Justin Verlander is fully prepared to attribute a reason. The reason the baseballs are reacting differently is that the league is juicing the baseballs. Is now what you're saying, Jay? Quote, yes, 100%. They've been using juiced balls in the home run derby forever. It's not a coincidence. I find it really hard to believe that Major League Baseball owns Rawlings and just coincidentally, the balls become juiced. End of quote. My bottom line on this, I couldn't respect it anymore. I don't just love the take. I love the fact that he's dropping F-bombs and idiots and not dancing around it and saying, well, it could be this or it might be that or maybe it's this. No, this guy's 100% clear about what it is and what's happening. And of course, this is the guy to come right out and say it and F-bomb the joint while he's doing it. think a lot of people are trying to come up with a lot of reasons why more home runs are being hit. Verlander isn't going to waste any time at all. He's cutting right to the chase. Right to the chase with F-bombs and idiot blasts. And I do respect the hell out of it. And he would know a lot better than me. Here's the problem, however. I love it. I respect it. But the problem is, and the problem for Verlander and every other pitcher is, I know why baseball would be doing this. Wink, wink. If, in fact, they are doing it. I understand why they'd be doing it. I know why they're juicing the ball. Because they want more home runs. They want more offense. They want more buzz. They want more hype. They want more attention. They want somebody to look at them. And the best way to do that is with home runs. You see, MLB is losing a battle for attention. They're losing the battle for headlines, for hearts, for minds, for eyeballs. The best way to win that back, or at least the best way in the past, has been with the long ball. Bring on the 500-foot bombs, the fireworks. Competent pitching, that's not going to get you headlines in July, but home runs will. Everybody is fighting for attention, and the way to win that battle is with highlights. And unfortunately, a strong six-inning outing is not going to get that done. Neither is a well-fielded ground ball or a solidly executed sack bunt. I mean, maybe it should, but folks don't give a damn about that. We know this. You're not going to drop what you're doing to watch some fundamentally sound baseball in the middle of July. Man, it's all about the home runs. The further, the better. The more, the better. Chicks still dig the long ball. Everybody does. And if Verlander is right, MLB has made the decision, and they're going to sacrifice pitchers and their reputations in order to get more buzz, more excitement, and more people to look at them, and that's why he's F-bombing them. And the problem is, I can't say that I blame him. You know, sort of like the NFL. Sort of like the NFL changing the rules and leaving the defense defenseless to create more offense and get more eyeballs. Offense sells. Offense puts people in the seats in all sports. So to end this, I do feel badly for pitchers, but I see the league working. They're chasing attention. They're chasing buzz. And right now they're fighting a losing battle. People will watch a pitcher's duel in October. It's awesome then, but they don't care about that in July. They're not going to get hyped on a 2-1 game in July. They will not come if that's how you build that. That's why Major League Baseball bought Rawlings, so they could mass produce their own Super Balls and put them into use across the board. Damn, what a coinkydink. Isn't it wild to see the ball jumping out of the yard the way it is right now? That is a real coincidence. Just don't bring that around Verlander, because he knows better, and for him it is a reason to go. I'm speaking of John Smoltz. It's good to have you back. John, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Always good to talk to you, John. So you're on the call for the All-Star game tonight. Let me start right there. Actually, before we get into tonight's game, if you were to go back, John, what do you remember about participating in the All-Star game as a player? For instance, how did you approach that game, and what are the types of memories that you took away from the event?
Well, you know, I was a fish out of water, first one. I was a young player, only one to represent Atlanta. It was in Anaheim. And the vast difference between today's All-Star game and back then, you know, more of a veteran appearance. You felt like, as a rookie, you just sit in your locker, just kind of, you know, you just didn't feel like you belonged. Today, every young player feels like they belong. They've been prepped and ready and making impacts. So when you're a young guy walking in a locker room today, it's so much different than it was 15, 20, 30 years ago, where there was a veteran presence. There was guys like 10, 12, 13, 14-time All-Stars in the locker room. Those days are dwindling and probably gone. And so I remember just sitting there and hoping to, you know, just feel like I could do my best. And if I even got in, well, I got in a strange way, because I was supposed to be in the bullpen, and Tommy Lasorda went to the phone and said, get Smoltzy up, and I'm in the dugout. So right there, I was already strike one, and I had to run in the tunnel, get in the bullpen, throw seven warm-up pitches. I was in my first All-Star game, and just it felt like a million miles an hour. And then once you get into more of them and you start feeling like you've checked in, that you're one of the guys that you competed against now with the best in the league, that's what it felt like then. Today, it is dynamically young and talented and impactful, and they're not afraid of anything, it seems like.
John Smoltz joining us. All right, so in terms of these players today, John, who are some of the guys that you're most looking forward to seeing tonight?
Well, when you look at the roster, and certainly the National League has, I think it's one of the best lineups I've seen them have in a long time. You know, guys are having breakout years. Yelich and Bellinger, it's amazing. We have a great mix of what the game celebrates today with home runs, velocity, speed, power. Like, you know, everyone's talking about home runs and strikeouts and all those things, but we got a great matchup of a guy like Ryu showing how you can pitch without velocity, hit your spots, and dominate. And then the ageless wonder of Verlander on the other side, who still is able to throw at 97 miles an hour, but go to cruise control, then turn it up. So it's really filled with a lot of guys. Like, you know, I get to watch in Atlanta Acuna Jr. do his thing. Now this is two halves in a row where he's dominated baseball. But then you get to appreciate guys who just go out and year in and year out are kind of underappreciated. Even Mike Trout, underappreciated greatness. All he does is dominate, and we just come to think that, oh, well, that's him. Feel-good stories and Brantley coming back to Cleveland, having a great year with Houston. So there's so much. The game is unlike any other game that I'll ever do. It's hard to prep. It's hard to get out in front of things because the game goes fast. People are in and out, and hopefully the matchups work in your favor if you're a pitcher or a hitter and trying to be successful.
John Smoltz helping get us ready for the All-Star game this evening. John, you mentioned the ageless wonder, Justin Verlander, and you mentioned home runs, and he was on that topic yesterday, of course. He said, John, that he believes, quote, 100% that MLB is juicing baseballs in order to get more home runs. What's your reaction when you hear that?
Well, I don't know what the percentage breakdown is, but let's just agree that there's something different, right? There's no doubt that you can't go against the evidence of what's taking place. So I liken it to this. There's more home runs percentage-wise because that's what's being rewarded today. So guys are trying to swing for the fences more than ever. So in that example would be in the NBA. There's more three-pointers than ever because there's more three-point shots ever taken in the history of the NBA. So the three-point shot's going to be king in the NBA. Home run's going to be king in baseball. Now, where the ball's traveling and at the rate at which it's traveling and the distances make you really ponder what's going on with the baseball. I don't particularly go as far to say as it's intentional, but I'm going to err on the side of a pitcher. You could blindfold me and put 10 different baseballs in my hand, and I can tell you everything you need to know about that baseball because I've held 2 million of them. It's no different than a photographer telling me what's the best angle for a picture. I'm going to trust him than my own eyes and the evidence of what, you know, maybe is seen. So the percentage breakdown is there's definitely something going on with the baseball. There's also the philosophy of the game that has changed it and kind of taken it to a new level. But the baseballs are definitely traveling a lot farther. And where it kind of goes over the top a little bit is that, you know, AAA for the first time is using Major League Baseballs. And you see their percentages have gone up over 50% of home runs in the AAA. So that should tell you what you need to know. Whether or not you get into the dirty of whether this was completely intentional or done, that's where I can't even begin to know what that was, if that's even a case. But both sides are acknowledging it. It's a matter of has it gone too far, right? Has the game gone to a place where balls that are being hit traveling exorbitant amount of distances, and then the balls that are being hit that typically normally are not home runs? That's where you scratch your head a little bit.
So, John, what do you think? If you were to answer that question yourself, has it gone too far?
I think that we're getting to that point, right, where, again, it's hard because when I pitched, and even I look over the last 15 years, guys' approach at the plate are totally different. To use another analogy, it would be like everyone trying to hit a 350-yard drive and having no finesse, not worried about whether they hit the fairway or not. The game has been proven analytically that if you want to score runs, you better hit the ball over the fence. We got defenses that are going to take away hits. We got pitchers whose velocity is in the upper 90s. So the best way to do it is to get the ball in the air, launch angle, all those things. I don't know long term if that's the great thing for baseball, that it'll turn into the, you know, most exciting way to watch it. I think every sport and every fact of life, the pendulum always swings too far. And then eventually it comes back and it self-corrects. This may take longer than most. The game eventually will revert back to certain fundamentals that make pressure on the other teams. Speed will come back in the game, I believe. I believe the pitcher will be asked to do more in the future. But at this current point, the talent pool is so good. If the injury rate keeps climbing, something will have to determine a change in how you manipulate a season rather than using so many more pieces per year.
John Smoltz joining me for a few more moments. All right, then, John, I mentioned off the very top that you've competed in three PGA Tour Champions events this spring. As an athlete, as a Hall of Famer, you're used to pressure situations. What's it like then to play on the Sunday in a Champions event?
It's way more difficult than I wanted it to be. I was hoping to use everything that I loved about postseason baseball. I was hoping to utilize that in a way where you know, that wouldn't allow me to be unnerved. And unfortunately, that's not been the case. I'm getting more comfortable, but I'm not confident enough to compete at that level to where, as casual golfers, we all feel like we can do X, Y, Z on any given day. And I'm learning more and more about myself as I head into Lake Tahoe in the American Century Championship, and I get a chance to compete there. That will seem so much easier than what I've been able to do in the greatest golfers of the world. So I have tremendous appreciation for them.
All right, so you've won the Diamond Resorts Tournament of Champions Celebrity Division in January. You did then. So now you're going to play in the American Century Championship this week in Tahoe. You've come really close at that event before. And Tony Romo, you and he are among the favorites this year. What would it mean for you to cash this one in and get that first win at the event?
Well, monkey off the back, expectations galore. Winning a tournament in Florida helped. I don't like just competing to finish close. I want to win. And so, I am going to try to knock that one off.
So John, how are you feeling about your game right now? How are you hitting them?
I haven't been able to play as much as I like, but if I can putt in Tahoe, I'm going to have a chance to win.
So Vlad Jr. won Home Run Derby last night. Man, what a show that was. What a show he put on. 91 home runs on the night, including a 121-second stretch where he had 25 swings and he went yard 19 times. The Blue Jays' official Twitter account condensed all 91 home runs into 60 seconds. It's mind-blowing. This is wild. I mean, the sound alone is absurd. All home runs. But then again, that's why you invite a 20-year-old who had only 8 home runs in the season to the Home Run Derby, because he's capable of something like that. And no, that was not nepotism. He didn't get that invite. He's still going, by the way. He's still hitting home runs. He didn't get that invite because of who or what his old man did. He got the invite because of what he does. Absolutely mash. Like when he broke the record for home runs in the first round last night with 29. Then he broke it again in the second round with 40. I mean, it was electric. What a performance. And then, wait, actually, Pete Alonso won the Home Run Derby. Because in that final round, he hit 23, while Vlad hit just 22. So I guess Pete Alonso is your 2019 Home Run Derby champ. Congrats, champ. I guess. And with respect to Pete, who the hell cares? I mean, I know Pete does. Pete walked away with a trophy and a mill. But in 10 years, is anybody going to remember Pete Alonso's 23 home runs in the final round? Hell, in 10 weeks. In 10 days. In 10 minutes. Hell no. If anybody remembers anything, they're going to remember Vlad hitting 91 bombs. But herein lies the problem with the Home Run Derby. The rules seem to change every single year. Like Vlad, he broke Josh Hamilton's record in the first round. But Hamilton did it in a completely different system. And nobody's going to get all fired up about that or turn into get off my lawn guy over home run derby rules. But it does seem a little bit weird that it seems like a completely different format every single time. I mean, there were innings, there were outs, then it was about time, then there were tiebreakers, you name it. They've tried it. Overtimes, gold balls, timeouts. Oh, speaking of timeouts, give me one right here. Let me take a timeout to say that Jackson Hayes dunking in a summer league game was nearly more exciting than most of the home run derby.
In the game prior, the Boston Celtics had Carol Lawson.
I want to apologize to Stephanie, but that was a showstopper.
You have to pause for the Hayes throwdown.
Jackson Hayes.
Dude, that was dirty. That was filthy. Cruel and unusual punishment to the poor Chicago Bulls Summer League player who rotated over to defend. Get murdered before being turned into a traffic cone in the Jackson Hayes dunk contest. That was felonious. Because someone is dead.
Carol Lawson.
But the fact that Hayes dunking in the summer league was getting run last night is kind of a problem for baseball. Last night and tonight were supposed to belong to baseball exclusively. And last night did belong to Vlad Jr., except when it didn't. Like, remember when Big Mac won the home run derby, smoking one off the light tower above the Green Monster in Fenway? Yeah, well, actually, he didn't win. He didn't make it past the second round even when he ran into Jeremy Burnitz. Remember when Josh Hamilton won the home run derby in Yankee Stadium by crushing one bomb after another? Surprise, he didn't win either. Justin Morneau did. And with all due respect to Justin, really good guy, really good player, but nobody remembers he won a home run derby because he didn't. He got the trophy, but he didn't win. It's kind of the feeling. That's kind of the thing, right? It's weird to get worked up about home run derby every single year, since every single year it's kind of weird and kind of, I don't know, unexciting. And then when it is exciting, when there are amazing moments, it's never the winner who is responsible for those moments. And there are always moments that come early in the competition because by the end, everybody's gassed out. I mean, like, I get it. These guys are swinging out their ass. It's tiring. It's kind of a thing. And kind of an issue for the event because you're not saving your best for last. The best always comes first, and then it becomes like a war of attrition, a battle of survival. It'd be like if everybody went with their biggest dunks in the first round of the slam dunk contest, and the final round was just guys doing like layups. It'd be like MJ taking off for the foul line in the first round and then going with a finger roll in the finals. Again, I'm sure Pete Alonso is seriously fired up about what he did last night. He should be. The check that he earned is nearly double his salary for the year. And he got a pretty sick trophy to boot. But what I'm saying is, it's kind of weird when at the end of the night, nobody's talking about the winner and everybody's talking about the guy who finished runner-up. The runner-up had 34 more home runs than the actual champion. The runner-up hit nearly 40,000 feet of home runs last night. But he lost to a guy who hit a lot less than that. In a few years, the only thing people are going to remember about this home run derby is Junior doing what he did and not what Pete Alonso did. And that's kind of a problem. Because if you have the alleged best derby ever and the best performer on the night didn't win it, that's a problem. But in a way, that is one of the most Mets things ever. Even when they do something well, even when they do something right, they don't. Sorry, Pete. But look at the bright side. At least your GM did not come running in to break a chair over your head when no one recognized that win. Nor will he do it 10 years from now when nobody remembers the win. So you've got that going for you, which is nice. And you got $1 million. So as long as that check doesn't float, you're good, I guess. I'm speaking of Terry Stotts. Terry, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well. What app do you miss the most?
Man, I knew you'd hit me up on that, Terry. You know what? The one that I miss the most is the one that is working the worst, Instagram. It will not open up. I cannot get it to open up on my phone because I've replaced the phone too many times in recent weeks. That's my take. How about you, Terry?
I would miss that. I would miss Instagram as well.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of a bad thing. How about you, Terry? Are you a big social media guy? Do you spend your
lot
of time?
I follow people. I don't post. I don't post anything, but I follow our players. I follow NBA people on Instagram. Follow our staff members on Instagram, and then and Twitter. You know, half my news comes on Twitter. So, but I don't post at all.
You don't Snapchat. You don't update your stories.
No, I've never Snapchatted.
I see you working. All right, Terry, it doesn't feel like it was that long ago that you and I were talking in the middle of the postseason, but so much has changed around the league since then. What have the last weeks, few weeks, been like for you? Have you been able to kind of unplug and get away, or has it been all about the work and the grind?
Well, you know, the offseason in the NBA kind of has a rhythm to it. Whenever your season is over, you know, you get some time off, and then you start gearing up for the draft, and we have young players come back in June and work out. And then once the draft over, you got a week to unwind, and then you get ready for summer league. I'm in Vegas right now with the summer league. And then when summer league's over, you got some downtime, and then you got a camp to go to. So it's August is the big month to kind of do a little bit of traveling. But like I said, every summer, every off season, I should say, has kind of a rhythm to it because of the things that you're required to do.
Terry Stotts joining us. Now, Terry, I know you're focused on the upcoming season, but as you look back on last season and everything this team went through, both on and off the court, and all the challenges that you faced and were able to overcome as a team and a staff, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Well, I'm incredibly proud of what we did. You know, on the heels of getting swept the previous season, an upset in the first round, we had to live with that. We fought through some injuries to have some new players come in, like Enes Kanter and Rodney Hood, to come in February and be a good addition. Our team stayed together even when Jusuf Nurkić got hurt. We had a very good regular season, but we knew that wasn't going to be the story. The story was whatever we did in the playoffs, and we maintained our focus. And for the majority of the players were on our team and had to go through the sweep against New Orleans to come through and get to the conference finals. I was very happy and proud of everybody who had to live through both of those experiences.
We're talking to Terry Stotts. Now, Terry, one of the pieces of news that is both new and not new is the fact that Damian Lillard agreed to a Supermax contract. You and I have been talking about Dame for years now. One of the things that you said recently is that the best teams are a reflection of their best player. What do you mean by that, and how much is this team a reflection of Dame?
Well, you know, the NBA is a players' league, and when you look through the history of the game, and I've been a student of the NBA for a long time, and I've been in it for the last 25 years. When you look at a Tim Duncan or Stockton Malone or Magic Johnson, or you just go down the list, Alonzo Mourning, great leaders, Patrick Ewing, the team is a reflection of their best players, and especially the successful teams. And Damian has been remarkable in that respect. He's been a great player on the court. He's been all pro, and he's been just very consistent on the floor. But what people don't realize, I know people have written about it, but they don't see the day-to-day leadership by example, talking to young guys, taking them aside, taking them to his house, taking them to a dinner. We talk about culture, and the culture doesn't mean anything. Neil O'Shea, our general manager, and I can say all we want about culture, but if your best player doesn't embody that, if he doesn't represent that, then it doesn't mean anything. So Damian came into the league as a rookie with a chip on his shoulder, became rookie of the year, but he didn't take the leadership role until we made changes in the roster. LaMarcus Aldridge left, and he carried the mantle and actually really looked forward to the responsibility that it takes to be the best player and to be a great leader.
We are talking to Trailblazers head coach Terry Stotts. And Terry, you made the point that you're in Vegas for the summer league. It's underway right now. So I'm curious, what kind of things are you looking for or looking to see from players as you evaluate them? Is it about production or is it about something else?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. Right now, you have your rookies, like we have Nasir Little, and he's like any rookie coming into summer league, it's a learning experience. It's not about how much better they're going to get. It's not about numbers. It's about, you know, it's more about learning. We spend time watching video with them. They're learning the NBA game. It's a quicker paced game, terminology, things that we want to do in our system. So for a player, a rookie like Nasir, it's just about learning. It's not about how he plays, because he's got plenty of time to do that. Then you look at our two rookies from last year, Gary Trent Jr. and Anfernee Simons. It's really an opportunity to put to use all the things that they worked on last year. Neither one of them got to play very much, but they worked very hard behind the scenes. And this is an opportunity for them to show how they've improved from this time last year. Gary Trent Jr. had 31 last night, shot the three really well. Anfernee Simons is getting some minutes at point guard. And so they're able to kind of show their improvement. And I always look at those second-year guys, or going into their second year, that they, you can see how much better they get from last year when things were coming 100 miles at them, 100 miles an hour, to this year where, okay, I got this, and this is what we do, and I know what I want to get done.
Gary Trent Jr. Terry, I feel like I was talking about Gary Trent Sr. not that long ago on this show.
Oh, he's here too.
Man, where does the time go? That's amazing. I literally feel like it was yesterday I was talking about him. Terry Stotts is joining us. You mentioned culture. You also made a move in a trade for Hassan Whiteside. So what does he bring to your team?
Well, you know, he brings a defensive presence to us. You know, without Yusuf, I don't know when Yusuf Nurkic will be back with us. Hopefully it'll be at some point during the season, but obviously we needed a starting center, and he brings a defensive presence. He's an effective scorer in the paint. I think him out there with Damian and CJ in pick and rolls, he's going to be playing with two guards that I think will make him a better player. He has a good relationship with Damian and CJ already, so I think he'll be a good fit. I think he was probably ready for a change of scenery, and you know, I expect from him kind of what Nurk gives us, you know, a defensive presence in the paint, a pick and roll, an effective role player, pick and roll player. And, you know, he'll get his touches on the blocks, but I think he's an efficient scorer in the paint. So I think he's a perfect fit for what we need this year.
Listen, I know you're focused on your team and your work, but what was your reaction when you saw Kawhi Leonard and Paul George join up with the Clippers?
Well, is that official? Can I officially talk about that?
You won't get in trouble with me if you do. I'm fine with it.
Well, I tell you what, it's
allegedly.
This has been an amazing offseason. I think I heard on some report the number of players, starters who have changed teams. Obviously, you've had players like Kawhi and Paul George, and change of scenery. It's really exciting, I think, for me, for the NBA, what's gone on, and it's kept interest very much high among fans and any basketball fan. But the West is tough. That more than anything else, you just realize how tough the West is. The Lakers now with Anthony Davis, the Clippers with their moves. You got teams like San Antonio, who's always good. Utah made some great moves. Denver is still solid, and they made a good trade yesterday. So I just look at how competitive the West is going to be. It was competitive enough last year. It's going to be even more so this year.
You know, it's really well stated by you. And in fact, I don't care what's going on with Golden State. You don't sleep on them either. So when you see everything that's happening in the West right now, does it impact the way you approach your season at all?
No, you know, I think we're going to kind of be an underdog again, even after being the 3 seed 2 years in a row. I think we're going to be a little bit of an underdog. And I think we flourish in that role. But the thing is, our guys know that how important every game is. And I think you're going to see teams, particularly in the Western Conference, play at a very high level consistently because of how important the game is. As far as our approach, you know, we do what we do. We're going to have – the challenge for us really is we lost 7 players off our team from last year. 6 of them all played in the playoffs. So incorporating new players into our system, how much we tweak what we do, but still having the core of Damian and CJ won't change things too much. But from my perspective, it's not really what other teams are doing. It's about how we incorporate our new guys and continue along with our system and finding out what works best for all our new players.
So from the moment that Paul George was dealt to the Clippers, the Oklahoma City Thunder were on the clock. Now, not on the draft clock for that massive haul of picks, but on the Russell Westbrook trade clock. Because there's no way you keep this guy. I know what he means to that team. I know what he means to that city. I know how long he's been there, how well he's played, how the guy was still good for a triple-double a night last season. But keeping him right now makes no sense. Not when everything about them is about collecting first-round picks for the future. Not when they owe him $171 million over the next four seasons. That's right. $171 million for the next four seasons, including a player option of $47 million in 22-23. On the surface, it would seem to make absolutely no sense to trade James Harden, Paul George, and Russell Westbrook within years of each other. But at the same time, once you've traded Paul George, what's the point in keeping a soon-to-be 31-year-old like Russell Westbrook around? What, so you can watch him average a triple-double again next season on a team that's going to get knocked out in the first round? This is why it was absolutely no shock to see this tweet from Woj. Quote, story filed to ESPN. In aftermath of Paul George's departure, OKC star Russell Westbrook is welcoming the idea of Sam Presti engineering a trade that would bring an end to his illustrious 11-year Thunder tenure. Miami's expressed interest, a destination that appeals to Westbrook. Let me just say that's a destination that appeals to Rome as well. Jimmy Butler and Russell Westbrook on the same team. Jimmy Butler and Russell Westbrook in the same locker room. That would be either the greatest combo ever or the worst combo ever. Either way, it's awesome. And that's not smoke either. That's not just smoke. According to the report, Westbrook and his agent are talking with the Thunder about the different options when it comes to ending his time there. And Miami is definitely in the cards. Westbrook is interested in going there. The Heat are interested in having him there. And I am interested in doing whatever I can to help facilitate that move. I know what you're thinking. Hey, Rome, you don't root. You say it every single day. So why are you rooting so hard for Russ to go to Miami? Hey, Rome, what about Detroit? Detroit's been mentioned as a possible landing spot. What do you have against the Pistons, Rome? Nothing. I've got nothing against the Pistons. Dwayne Casey is one of my favorite coaches in the NBA. But this runs a lot deeper than that. Like when Jimmy Butler went to the Heat, I feel like the world missed an opportunity. Putting Butler and his passion into that cauldron in Houston with Chris Paul and James Harden would have been incredible. You know, that whole give me an A or give me an F thing? That definitely would have been one of the two, and probably an F. It would have been a home run or a strikeout, and probably a backwards K. And there was no way there were going to be any doubles there. So when that didn't happen and Butler ended up taking his talents to South Beach, I was disappointed and we all lost. But the possibility of Butler and Westbrook together in Miami, that would be awesome. And that would redeem Butler going to Miami. Sign me up for it. Because they could be exactly what each other needs. A guy who's passionate, fired up, speaks his mind, and battles. Or they could be exactly what the other guy doesn't need. A guy who's passionate, fired up, speaks his mind, and battles. If those two get on a roll, look the hell out. If those two hit a losing streak, look the hell out. What I'm saying is, I couldn't love this idea any more than I do. Except, there is one idea that I love even more. And I love it so much, I don't even want to talk about it. Like tomorrow's podcast guest, I love so much I don't want to talk about this idea because I don't want to jinx either one of those things. Kind of feels like talking during a no-hitter. But you know what? I'll do it because I'm not afraid of jinxing it. And in fact, I want to speak it into existence. The only thing better than Russell Westbrook teaming up with Jimmy Butler in Miami is Russell Westbrook teaming up with Chris Paul and James Harden in Houston. And according to reports, that also may be a possibility. I mean, there is that obvious salary issue, but if anybody can figure that out, it's Daryl Morey. You imagine the beard? Think about this. The beard, CP3, and Russ. The beard, CP3, and Russ together. If CP3 is getting bent about how the beard plays, Can you imagine CP3 trying to deal with how the beard and Russ play together? Now, that sounds like the best thing ever. If it's not, I know it's the best thing ever for the Rockets. The Clippers just added two MVP candidates. The Lakers have two of their own. It's an arms race in the West. And you know Morey is not going to back down from that. He never backs down from anything. I don't know if Russ, James, and Chris can beat LeBron and AD or Kawhi and PG. I just know I've got to see it. I've got to have it. Houston has to make that happen because it's either going to work and end in a parade or it's going to fail and end with a smoking crater. And either way, we win. Either way, it works. The only thing better than sticking Russ in the same locker room with Jimmy Butler is sticking Russ in the same locker room with CP3 and the beard. Truth is, not only do I want that, I'm not sure I've ever wanted anything as much as I want that. And if anyone can make that happen, it's Daryl Morey. Man, time to go to work, D. Time to do some work. Russ, CP3, and Butler. I learned something also early on in college, in communication studies, that you don't want to have three kids. You never want to have three because it's, quote, always a dyad plus one. In other words, it's always two ganging up on the other. You know how that would go. Imagine Russ and the beard ganging up on CP3. CP3 standing in the middle of the court, glaring these guys down after the officials and the opposition. Man, I want that so badly. Russ and the beard and CP3 and one basketball. Best thing ever. Come on, Daryl, make that happen. They got to move this guy. You can't keep Russ around. He's going to turn 31, making that kind of money. You've got all those draft picks. So for who? For what? So he can kill himself, get another triple-double, have his shooting percentage drop down to the low 20s, and have them go out in the first round? Let's go to Kansas City. JJ, good to have you on, JJ. What's up?
Mr. Rome, how are you, brother?
Good, good, JJ. What's up with you?
Hey, my man, we are 10 days away from the start of the weekend of the inaugural Jungle Open, my man. It's going to be epic. Friday, if you guys are getting together, play an early round, and then Saturday is really the main event. The TPC course in Omaha is going to see about 30-plus clones descend on it. And, you know, thank God you didn't take Matt in L.A.'s call yesterday, because here, just let me help you out. From Australia to L.A., from Wisconsin to Texas, you're welcome. Yeah, man, we got clones coming in from all over, my man. And see, that's because of you, Rome. It just is. Like, the only reason people go to Omaha, you got Warren Buffett, you got the College World Series, and now you got you, dude. It's just right up there. 512 Lumber, the bro of 12-wood, put up this awesome graphic logo on Twitter. It's awesome. It's going to be Caddyshack meets the jungle, my man. I am truly hoping a beer cart girl has to see a clone go into liver and or kidney failure about the eighth hole. It'll be great. Those who survive Saturday and Saturday night, play again on Sunday. And, you know, Dave and KC, he's been really the head behind this whole thing. He's been strong-arming it. It's awesome. We might be a little low rent for you, Rome, and I know Ike was like a member at Augusta National back in the day. We've invited Hawk. I don't think he can make it without throwing out his back. But the U.S., that's James Kelly. Can we get flight deck? I mean, Omaha, park his ship right there, bro. Or if anything, can we just buy some space on his forehead? That billboard space will put up all the tweets and everything right there. Now, this isn't all about nice radio. It's not all about us coming together and being all it is. But I have to say this. Rick in Buffalo, you pompous, that tweet that you should be interviewed. Oh, my God, dude. You came in second place. That's the biggest achievement in your life. And remember, second place is just first loser. You love things with the number two, don't you? When you RSVP called for your freaking snack off call, you said, oh, put me at the bottom of the second hour because I need to squeeze in a deucer.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Let's go to Michigan. Kurt is on line one, and he's in Michigan. Hey, Kurt, how are you?
What's up, Jim? That's the Upper Michigan, and it's the Muscle Shark calling you.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
So now, Muscle Shark, you've joined a very elite fraternity. meet all your other members?
Levi the Trash Man.
Ah! It's Iceman.
Ah! Lonnie Carter in Spokane.
Ah! The Axe.
Ah! Bighorn from Windsor, Ontario.
Ah! They call me the bowling ball here in Tampa.
Ah! Jay Dizzle.
Ah! Manny Cheeseburger over here.
Ah! Who by the name of Shot Callers.
Ah! The Clone Prophet.
Ah! This is the Grump.
Ah! This is the Grouch.
Ah! Moldoggy in NorCal, East Bay to be exact.
Ah! The Dougler. I'm from the city of Fad Diets and Yoga Pants.
Ah! The Zookeeper.
Oh, good gloss. Where did that come from?
At a buddy's wedding.
So you gotta call me Roaster.
Actually, this is Garbage Man, Brad.
Not Jonathan, it's Jip.
My boys call me the Cracker Jack.
G-Money.
Actually, they call me Sexy Rexy from New Mexi.
They call me the Red Dog.
Let's go with Horse Monkey today.
On the court, they call me the Tree Frog.
This is G-Money, Rack Me James.
All right, Dave, see you, bud. Wait a minute, G-Money? He's with self-gloss.
Dr. B-Man SD. Bow down.
You could call me Z-Man.
Yes, hey, Jim Rump. Actually, it's Titan Woman.
His silly rabbit.
It's actually not Barry. My friends call me the... Ooh, Barracuda.
And it's the Muscle Shark calling you.
That's not a good call. No.
I don't care what your boys call you. I don't care what your friends call you. I don't care what your family calls you. I don't care what your teammates call you. We call you by your name. And if you earn gloss here, then you have it. But until you earn it here, it doesn't matter. Will Brinson is my guest. Good to have you, Will. How are you?
Jim, what's going on, man? Hope all's well in this dead period of the summer.
It's all good. And the best thing is, it's no longer a dead period, right? There's so much going on. NBA offseason, NFL offseason. The All-Star break right now. Let's talk some football. Let me start with the Falcons, Will. Julio Jones told TMZ that he's going to take the Falcons at their word that they'll take care of a new contract. And as a result, he is not going to hold out. What's your reaction to that news?
Well, a couple reactions, Jim. One, why does Julio Jones only talk to TMZ, and why does he only talk to them at airports? And how did they even realize it was Julio Jones when he's wearing a hoodie? It was very impressive work by the Atlanta area TMZ people. And two, I would say to Julio that you can be a little hopeful that Arthur Blank will you know, pay up as he promised, because you're Julio Jones. You've averaged almost 1,600 receiving yards the last 5 years. You're a dominant freak of nature who destroys everything in his path when it comes to catching footballs. But I would warn Julio and any NFL player that, as CBA negotiations loom, that maybe it's best not to take the owner's word for it when it comes to getting paid. If they did that, they would probably all have guaranteed contracts and be much less concerned about the future of labor negotiations. Now, that being said, I think Julio will probably get paid. I think it's a good time to pay him. He's got 3 years left on his deal, so you can – or, you know, 2 years left or whatever it is. You can extend him and get him to 5 years and maybe just say, all right, this will make him a Falcon for life. We can figure out the final few years of his career as needed down the road. He signed a pretty good deal, 5 years, $71 million back in 2015. Probably time to re-up and get him on that level of Odell Beckham, Antonio Brown, all the other top-end wide receivers out there.
We're talking to Will Brinson. So bottom line that for me, if he does get paid what he's worth and he's paid like the other top-end wide receivers, what kind of a contract are we talking about?
Well, I would say it depends on whether he wants to try and go with a full 5-year new deal or whether it's just an extension. But I think we'd be looking at something that breaks the bank in terms of – or resets the market, so to speak. I mean, Antonio Brown got paid by the Steelers and then got repaid by the Raiders. Odell Beckham has sort of indicated, Jim, that he wants to be repaid by the Browns not very long after being paid by the Giants. And I think Julio Jones is in that group. And, in fact, you could make the case that Julio Jones is better than those guys based on his performance on the field and his willingness to be a quiet, good teammate who, you know, only rarely scrubs his Instagram profile of all things Falcons. So, I would say we're looking at, probably something in the, $100-plus million range, depending on how many years they want to tack on here.
Will Brinson is joining us. All right, Will, as long as we're talking about contracts, let's talk Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota for a minute. What are your thoughts about Tampa Bay and Tennessee having, or what thoughts are they having about their respective quarterbacks and their contracts right now as they enter their final years?
Jim, it's the ultimate nightmare if you're a franchise, because you spent a top two pick respectively on these players, right? 1 and 2 when they came out in that draft. And you are in absolute quarterback limbo because you can't have seen enough from either one of these guys to commit to a long-term deal. I mean, Marcus Mariota has been efficient and outstanding at times. He still flashes that athleticism. He can make precision throws. He went a very long time without throwing a red zone interception in his career, but he just doesn't have that. He hadn't shown that top end ability to be a franchise quarterback and the guy you want to give, you know, $30 million a year to. And so I think you need to see, if you're John Robinson, a healthy 16 game season. I think you want to see something in the neighborhood of 4,000 passing yards and something, you know, in the range of 35 to 40 touchdowns to really feel comfortable going up top with Mariota. Even if he does that, I would anticipate they franchise tag him and try to figure something out down the road or make him prove it a second year. And then with Jameis, I mean, there's even more added to the mix because his highs have maybe been higher than Mariota, but his lows have been lower. He's got off-field issues dating back to Florida State. You know, hasn't been able to put it together over the course of a full 16-game season. And if it doesn't work with Bruce Arians, I don't know who it's going to work with, Jim, because you talk about pairing, you know, you look at Carson Palmer and how he thrived once he got paired up with Bruce Arians in Arizona. You can make the case that this is the perfect fit for Jameis Winston. Bruce Arians' motto is no risk it, no biscuit, and there's no bigger, like, just completely oblivious to chucking it down the field type of guy and he has no conscience when it comes to throwing interceptions than Jameis Winston. So in my mind, if you're the Bucs, what you need to see is a big time season out of Jameis Winston, 16 games, no trouble off the field, leadership qualities in the locker room. And if he does that, you're probably looking at a franchise tag situation, but maybe you're willing to commit if you can buy low on him.
No risk it, no biscuit. Will Brinson joining us, one of my favorites. All right, so we're talking about off-field issues right now and high-end players. Zeke Elliott. The league announced that Elliott's not going to be suspended. What do you make of that decision and of Elliott's statement in response?
Yeah, it felt like as soon as that statement came out, Jim, that Zeke Elliott, you could tell it was like a, hey, you might want to go out and apologize right now. You know, that's what he heard from Roger Goodell. And this is a pretty big win for the Cowboys in terms of their 2019 season and Zeke Elliott in terms of trying to prove that he deserves a contract from, you know, for the long haul from the Cowboys. Now, whether they give it to him, that's a whole different ball of wax. This is a team that drafted two running backs sort of surprisingly this year. Makes you wonder. I know the incident happened after that, but it makes you wonder what they think about Zeke Elliott and his ability to stay out of trouble over the long haul. Clearly, the NFL was willing to bring Zeke in and potentially say, hey, listen, man, we're going to suspend you again. I mean, he's in the danger zone now, Jim, where because he had that one suspension, because he's had this second incident, you know, because he has some stuff dating back to his Ohio State days, where if he had something serious pop up again, he would be looking at a potential one-year banishment based on the NFL's personal conduct policy. Now, maybe that gets reworked in the next CBA, but I still think this is a guy, Zeke Elliott, where – you know, you got to tread lightly when you talk about his long-term ability to be on the field. When he plays, there's no one better at the position. He's led the league in rushing 2 out of his 3 years and only missed. He led the league in rushing yards per game the year he was suspended. So, I mean, we're talking about the best running back in football when he's on the field. He just hasn't shown an ability to do that. And I think the Cowboys dodged a major bullet here by not losing Zeke for multiple games.
We're talking to Will Brinson. All right, Will, what about the incident? An incident which has video of Browns running back Kareem Hunt outside the Barley House in Cleveland. First off, what do you make of the incident? And then as a follow, if you're the Browns front office, what's your reaction when you hear there's been yet another incident involving Kareem Hunt?
Well, I'm not going to tell anybody in their 20s to stop going out at night because that would make me a complete hypocrite. But when you've got this sort of thing floating around you, if you're Kareem Hunt, you should lock yourself in a, like, go to like Dutch Pennsylvania country and lock yourself in a cabin for 6 months and wait until you're reinstated. And don't go near a club, whether it's Cleveland, Vegas, Cincinnati. I mean, Raleigh. Don't go to a club anywhere. Don't get near any booze. He admitted when he first got in trouble that alcohol probably played a role in these incidents. And I don't want to ascribe intent as to what happened outside that nightclub, because for all we know, those guys were joking around and it wasn't a big deal. But the reality is, you are a public figure who has been popped by the NFL and popped by law enforcement for multiple issues involving alcohol and violence, usually later at night in situations. And so the best thing you can do if you're Kareem Hunt at your age, with your contract status, with your future in the league in jeopardy, is to stay away from all that stuff. And that's why it's so shocking to see it happen. And it makes you wonder, look, John Dorsey said there was going to be a zero tolerance policy with Kareem Hunt when they brought him into Cleveland. I mean, it seems like that might be maybe a not quite zero tolerance policy, because this would be, if this is a lesser player, Jim, he's gone. I mean, they're not going to put up with this. I think Kareem Hunt's talent is probably giving him a second or third chance here. But he needs to, he could be in for, a world of hurt when it comes to his future in the league and future with the Browns if he has another incident.
Got a few more moments with Will Brinson talking NFL with him. Now, Will, of course, you are the leader of the Philip Rivers Army. In fact, you declared him the greatest quarterback in ACC history. Look, I've always had a ton of respect for Phil Rivers, both as a player and as a leader. For those who doubt him, lay out the argument as to why he is still underappreciated.
Yeah, I just think, Jim, one of the things that sets Philip Rivers apart is his toughness. This is the thing that people always forget is that he played in an AFC championship game with a torn ACL. I mean, what player in the history of football has rolled out there the next week after tearing their ACL with no knee ligaments in place and then just gone out and played? And I'm not going to say they came that close to beating the Patriots in that game in New England, but I mean, they gave a decent effort, and Philip Rivers on, basically one leg. It's pretty hard to do. And by the way, he didn't miss a single game. He was back at training camp the next year. I think no one is tougher when it comes to staying in the pocket, making throws down the field. He's never complained once in his career about the lack of weapons around him. And he's had some good stretches. LaDainian Tomlinson, Antonio Gates, but there was a time period there where the Chargers had nothing around him. They moved him to Los Angeles. I think that I like to give him a little bit of Phil Mickelson action, Jim, because, not just, sort of goofy white dude who, flops around and doesn't win anything right away. But, like, you look at Philip Rivers, Tom Brady's his Tiger Woods. In another era, Philip Rivers comes in and maybe wins a Super Bowl or wins two Super Bowls and is a lock for the Hall of Fame. But having to play in the same conference as Tom Brady for basically the entirety of his career, that's like having to play up against Tiger Woods head-to-head in golf. And so I think from that perspective, Rivers has really flown under the radar. People don't treat him as a surefire Hall of Famer, and he should be, because he's the second best, if not maybe the best quarterback in that 2004 draft class.
All right, so finally, what kind of a season do you expect then from Rivers and the Chargers?
Well, I took the year off last year with my Chargers Super Bowl predictions, Jim, but I think I'm back. I'm back in full force. I'm going Chargers all the way. It's probably unlikely, but I think given the turmoil in that division with everything Kansas City's dealing with, some possible regression for Patrick Mahomes, the way that the Chargers have built out that defense, I think they should be the favorite. They're not the betting favorite in Vegas. They're like 2-1 to win the division. I think it's a really good bet to take the Chargers there. Not that I think the Chiefs will be bad. I just think they could take a step back. And I think this is really Los Angeles' year to make a leap forward. And if they can stay healthy going into the playoffs, I think they're a team that can make a run and maybe pull off a Super Bowl victory. So I'm making that bold prediction now, and I look forward to it being thrown in my face when it's wrong in November.
I love it. You got to do it. He's a CBS Sports senior writer, host of the Pick 6 NFL podcast, good friend of the program, has always been on our TV shows too, Will Brinson. Great job, Will. Good to have you back. Thanks for doing that.
Always a blast, Jim. Have a good day.
Good night.